Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. This Thanksgiving, a coronavirus test may go hand in hand with turkey and stuffing. Yes, many in the Commonwealth are following the recommendations from health authorities, staying home for the holiday or using Zoom or gathering outdoors instead of having the traditional indoor family affair. But among those who are intent on trying to gather indoors, many hope to decrease the odds of transmission by getting a coronavirus test in advance. There's the problem. That is easier said than done, with long lines stretching out at testing sites all over the state. Here to tell us more is WBUR's Carrie Goldberg. Welcome back to the show, Carrie.
Thank you, Tiziana.
I know you're following this, so tell us what you've been seeing.
Well, yes, actually, I'm just back from Dot House Health. That's a community health center in Dorchester. And you can kind of see the testing system straining at the seams. So I was there at about noon. There were already more than two dozen people waiting outside, even though the testing wouldn't start until one. And then these two staffers came out and they started handing out cards, giving people a specific time slot so they could leave and then come back so they wouldn't have to wait in line for hours. Here's Maria Papadopoulos. She's the health center's director of clinical operations.
The last couple days have been extremely busy. Like, we ran out of our time slot tickets yesterday at like 10 o'clock, and we were testing till 4. So you can imagine how long these lines have been. Blocks and blocks. Yeah, and sometimes they loop into our parking lot.
And she says they're testing about 150 people a day, and they would test more, but they're limited by the amount of staff they have.
So is this just a Thanksgiving rush, Carrie?
Well, I think it's more than that. Papadopoulos says it's the surge and it's the holidays and it's Mayor Marty Walsh telling Bostonians a couple of weeks ago that they should all get regularly tested. Now, nobody in line wanted to be interviewed on the record, but one woman told me she uses public transportation to take her baby for medical care. So these days she's getting tested once a month. And she was so eager, she arrived at 7 a.m., though then she came back later when she realized she didn't need to be there that early. But we're hearing about much longer lines than usual all over the place. In Marlboro, CBS Boston reports that when their Stop the Spread sites started, they were doing 50 or 100 tests a day. And last Friday, they did more than 800. And the director of the Board of Health in Lawrence, Mike Armano, says they've seen an increase in daily testing from about 200 people a day to over 900 people as the holiday approaches.
So let's review this, Carrie. Let's talk about the efficacy of getting a test before going to see people for Thanksgiving. How effective is that in protection?
Well, I mean, Armano from Lawrence says, you know, you should not assume that getting a test now means you're in the clear.
Testing is only a snapshot in time, so it shouldn't be used as a free pass to go to a gathering or a free pass to travel. It should be used to bring awareness that you have COVID-19 or not.
And Tiziana, to expand on that a bit, you know, the research shows that if you're infected, you can go from having an undetectable level of virus to peak viral load and being very infectious in just about 3 days. So all the testing experts I've heard on this really discourage people from feeling like testing provides, as Armano says, a free pass for something like a gathering.
So let's talk about getting the responses back, you know, your results. Can people get them soon enough for Thanksgiving? Does it vary depending on the type of test or location?
Right. So that's another issue. Now, most tests that are done these days are still PCR, the most accurate kind. And the trouble is that the wait for those results varies a lot from just a day or so to nearly a week. Like this morning, Tufts Medical Center tweeted this very apologetic tweet that it will take 5 business days for results right now because of this rise in demand. So clearly a test you get today is just not going to help you for Thanksgiving.
So I want to point out, we're not trying to discourage people from getting tests. Testing is important. It is a key strategy. That being said, state and local officials have been urging residents to do it, but I'm wondering how feasible it is given what we're seeing. Can our Commonwealth keep up with the demand?
Right. So just to underscore what you say, testing is important. It's especially important because this virus spreads even though you don't have symptoms. So it's very important to know your status. In terms of the state, you know, clearly they're having a very tough time keeping up right now. But I'd like to think that this is a kind of a transitional period as we move toward broader testing. Like, I've been doing some reporting lately about New England colleges, and it's looking like their experience this fall, where they brought a lot of students on campus, but they tested the heck out of them, is still more evidence that really broad testing of people, even without symptoms, so what's called surveillance testing, is a powerful tool for controlling transmission, because you can catch outbreaks before they get really big.
So that's at colleges that can afford to pay for that level of testing. What about statewide?
Well, a really leading expert on testing, Dr. Michael Minna at Harvard Chan School of Public Health, is pushing for the use of quick, cheap tests like antigen tests on strips of paper for really widespread testing. And there are those and other promising technologies that seem to be coming soon for easier, cheaper tests. They're less sensitive, but the argument is that what matters is whether you're contagious, and they're sensitive enough to pick that up. But for now, though, it seems like the state is stuck just trying its best to expand testing capacity and keep trying to persuade people to use it, even though we're hearing so many complaints about how inconvenient it can be.
Carrie, should the state have done something different to prepare for this moment? We've been hearing about second surge for quite a while.
So we have. I feel like before I want to second guess anybody, we should note that Massachusetts really is a leader in testing. You know, at latest count, we were doing more than 80,000 tests a day, and the Broad Institute alone has hit over 100,000 tests a day because it does colleges from other New England states as well. But what I'm hearing is that there are these bottlenecks in the system, and they're mainly at the sites that do the testing, you know, things like staffing, as we heard from Dorchester, registration, traffic flow. And I imagine the state is working as we speak on ramping up capacity significantly more. As Maria Papadopoulos at Dot House Health said, this is all still new and they're figuring it out.
And what do these lines now tell us, Carrie, about the rest of the holiday season?
Well, you know, what I'm thinking, Tiziana, is that people are going to see what happens after Thanksgiving. And if they see that really was a pretty bad idea for them to have gotten tested and then gone to their gatherings at Thanksgiving, I suspect that there will not be as much demand before Christmas. But that remains to be seen.
Well, WBUR's Carrie Goldberg, thanks for joining us, and happy Thanksgiving.
You too, my friend. Don't smoke too many cigars.
Now we want to bring you an update on our story from yesterday about the Emmy Rose, the Maine-based ground fishing vessel that went missing off the coast of Provincetown early Monday morning. There were four men in the crew: Jeff Matthews, Ethan Ward, Michael Porpa, Robert Bleffin. The Coast Guard called off its search for them late yesterday afternoon after covering nearly 2,000 square miles of water.
It is difficult to give up those last few bits of hope that you have that you'll have some sort of Thanksgiving miracle.
That's Hank Soule. He manages the Sustainable Harvest Sector, a fishing co-op that included the Emmy Rose. Soule knew Bob Bleffin, the captain, but he says at times like this for the fishing community, all four men are friends and family.
It's a door that closes firmly, and that's difficult. And unfortunately, in this industry, which by its very nature is dangerous, we've seen those doors close many times over the years.
Now, Soule says his thoughts are with their loved ones.
It's still early, and of course, they're the ones who are having the most difficulty dealing with the situation. We'll wait for them to reach out to us, but when they do, we'll be there for them.
Once again, Jeff Matthews, Ethan Ward, Michael Porpa, Robert Bleffin. Our thoughts are with their families, too. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Efficacy rates in phase 3 trials as high as 95%. Possible availability in the coming weeks. The promise of a coronavirus vaccine is quickly becoming a reality. But having a vaccine isn't enough. People have to take it. And recent studies find skepticism, especially from people of color. That skepticism worries Reverend Liz Walker, the pastor of Roxbury Presbyterian Church. So she went straight to the top authority to make the case for the vaccine. Last night, she hosted Dr. Anthony Fauci for her congregation.
I totally understand what you've been through, and I plead with you that we as a community, your community, the community that we all live in, can do something about this if we abide by the public health measures and get vaccinated. Don't deprive yourself of the advantage of an extraordinarily important advance in science by not getting vaccinated. Protect yourselves, your family, and your community.
Dr. Fauci is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and serves on the White House's coronavirus task force. Reverend Liz Walker herself serves on Governor Baker's COVID-19 vaccine advisory group and is a former news anchor on WBZ-TV. She is with us now. Reverend Walker, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Tiziana. It's good to be here with you.
Why did you become an active proponent for the coronavirus vaccine?
You know, it just... It's concerning to me how many people in the community that I serve are getting sick. I mean, that's a reality. And so with the disproportionate amount of illness and death in our community, we've got to do something. I have had my own kind of skepticism. I think a lot of people have about vaccines and Operation Warp Speed and all that we've been hearing. So I wanted to learn as much as I could so that I could pass on to the community that I serve immediately in my congregation, in our trauma program, the Corey Johnson Trauma Program, and beyond, to just spread the information that I'm learning and hopefully inspire other people to get as much information as they can get.
So 2,000 people registered for your event last night. That is a big number. Did that surprise you?
I was a little overwhelmed. I was glad. Of course, that's open to people all over the country and, you know, people who get our newsletters, people who have heard it word of mouth. So we can't tell you exactly who those people were. But I think it speaks to how much concern there is about this issue. And people want to hear, you know, the truth, and they want to hear from Dr. Fauci. So I think it was a little bit of all of that. And I was really satisfied, really glad that so many people registered and turned out.
So last night before Dr. Fauci started talking, you did this live poll where you asked attendees if they would take the vaccine, and about 35% said no. That's actually a lower level of skepticism than, for example, there was a September study reported in yesterday's Washington Post, which saw fewer than 50% of Black survey respondents willing to take the vaccine. It was 66% of Latinx people surveyed. But, you know, 35 out of every 100 congregants is still a fairly big number. Are you concerned about our ability to get to herd immunity with this kind of reticence?
From what I've learned about herd immunity, I am concerned. I don't know, because we don't know the exact demographics of that poll. You know, if it reaches all our congregants or our congregants and more, who was there? But I think that that's a scary number, no matter what, because we've got to have, from what I understand, the more people who get the vaccine, you know, the better we are as a country. So, and the safer it is for everybody. So we've got to get, you know, more people on board. And I'm not clear that 33%, it really covers my community. From what I've done anecdotally in speaking to people, far greater number, I'd say, are hesitant to take this vaccine. Now, that may be changing now that information is coming out, that these companies are, you know, saying they actually have this incredible efficacy. So we'll have to wait and see.
I do think that's worth noting. You know, a lot of the polls that I've looked at over the last week or so, they're from September. They're from a time before these efficacy numbers in these last few weeks are coming out. I want to acknowledge Dr. Fauci said last night that Black skepticism of the medical establishment, which can be behind this skepticism of the vaccine, is rooted in real history. Here he is.
Is it a broad generic reason, a distrust of the medical establishment because of the history of the abuse, particularly of the African-American community, with things that date back as far as Tuskegee and Henrietta Lacks issues? Or is it something about the process of the speed with which this vaccine was developed and somewhat of the mixed signals that one has been getting in this divisive society.
So Tuskegee referring, for example, to a syphilis experiment that was done on Black Americans for decades by the government in secret. What are you hearing? You said you think that number is even bigger than like the 33% number you got from this survey last night. What are you hearing from your congregation about why they might not take the vaccine?
Well, you know, I think it is absolutely what Dr. Fauci said. I think the history that is becoming, you know, available, more of us know the history now, but these were stories that were passed down in Black, you know, families forever and ever and ever. But I also think it's the everyday experience that Black people, that many Black people, at least the ones that I've talked to, themselves have had, who feel disrespected when they go to healthcare facilities, who feel unheard, who feel that they're not taken seriously. That's a very real thing. There's research to back that up, particularly around Black women. So I think it's a mixture of all of that. I also think it's a social issues of justice and the deaths of unarmed Black men. I think you have to, you know, it's a cumulative effect of feeling traumatized in a country that doesn't hear you, that doesn't treat you fairly. So those are the things that I hear from people that I talk to in my congregation. And I understand that that's decades and decades of distrust. And it's going to take a real effort and some time to turn that around. Do we have enough time with the urgency of this pandemic and the urgency of getting this vaccine out? That's the big question. And that's why so many people, and I'm not the only one, I appreciate, you know, the publicity that's around this event with Dr. Fauci. There are many people in my community who are concerned and working hard, doctors of color, social workers of color, people who are in the community who are trying to make sure that people get the right information, the truth, so that people can arm themselves and be safe.
You know, you said you appreciate the publicity, but it's not just you. I mean, it is remarkable. You are the pastor of an important but local Boston congregation, and Anthony Fauci took the time to address your community because he is so serious about making sure that there is uptake on this vaccine. That, I think, in and of itself, does that feel to you like that's really underscoring the importance of us getting over this hump?
Absolutely. I was stunned when we even came up with the idea, and I can't quite remember, but something said, call Dr. Fauci. But it wasn't it wasn't done thinking that Anthony Fauci was going to answer my call, but it was my concern, you know, and my willingness to take the risk. But when he responded, his office responded the next day. But last night he said something that just stayed with me right at the beginning of our conversation, I think it was, or maybe two or three questions in. He felt that it was his purpose. He was asked, how are you coping? And he says, the reason that I'm coping, or the reason I'm continuing to do what I'm doing, is because this is what my purpose is. This is what my, kind of like he didn't say these words, but my call, this is what I've been put on earth to do. And I think he's a man on a mission. So, and he only could stay with us for 30 minutes because he had a whole list of Zoom calls. So I think he's doing, and it's really remarkable to think about that. He's 79 years old. And I'm not saying that that's anything, you know, the older you get, the less that seems old, he doesn't care. He's going to do this. He's going to remain on his mission to get the word out. So I think he's a man who is obsessed with this mission. And I have a lot more respect for him because he didn't know me. He didn't know, you know, we have a small church. It wasn't anything like, you know, I had some contact. He's just on a mission.
You know, we have, well, let me backtrack and just tell listeners, we're talking to Reverend Liz Walker, the pastor of Roxbury Presbyterian Church, who invited and was surprised to get an acceptance from Dr. Anthony Fauci to address the community last night about the vaccine. We have been talking, Reverend Walker, about reticence in communities of color to take the vaccine. But that number is, you know, the reticence exists across the country. Again, these are September polls. But then there was one that Gallup released on Tuesday that showed that 58% of adults who were surveyed were willing to be vaccinated. That was up from 50% in September, but it's still, you know, that's 58%. It's still a low number. What are the other hurdles that we have to cross in order to get people to take it?
Well, you know, we politicized everything these days. I was, you talk about shock. The idea that a mask could be politicized like it has been is just amazing to me. I can't wait for history to kind of put its mark on what's been going on here, because I think it's more than any one person. But I think that whole polarized atmosphere that we have in this country is so dangerous on so many levels. People don't get enough information. They get a lot of disinformation. And so, you know, this is all kind of, it's like the perfect storm of everything wrong, you know, that everything that could go wrong has gone wrong as far as trying to move us forward as human beings, really. So all of that, I think, is what's kind of affecting this this situation we're in right now. And I'm very concerned. I don't know what it's gonna take to break this kind of impasse where I was just at this point of who, you know, I don't know. I must sound hysterical, but I think sometimes I get very frustrated because it's a scary time. You have people not trusting for this reason. You have people not trusting for that reason. Nobody wants to talk to anybody. Nobody believes anybody. Nobody trusts anybody. We're at a critical point in history. I'm very concerned.
I want to come back for a minute to communities of color. Back in September, presidents of two historically black colleges volunteered to test subjects for an experimental vaccine for the virus. According to the Washington Post, they did receive some backlash from members of the black community who didn't trust the trials. Some more sound here from Dr. Fauci last night, who pushed back that it's essential for people of color to get involved in early stages here.
We want to be able to say in the actual trial that proves that a vaccine is safe and effective, we can look our African American and our Latinx colleagues in the eye and say, you know what? We've proven that it is not only safe and effective in whites, it's safe and effective in you and your community.
Vaccine development has been faster, and we have heard this time around, Reverend Walker, this open conversation about making sure that trials include people of color, include the broad range of people who will be taking the vaccine to be sure of its efficacy and to build that trust. Will that be how we do things going forward?
I hope so. I hope that voices will rise up more and more from the community. I think those two presidents of historically black colleges that, you know, stepped out there and took the risk and took some backlash and took some abuse were courageous. I think it's going to take that kind of courage to help save us. Some people aren't taking this vaccine, you know, the disease seriously, even now. And that to me is the most baffling of all the things that keep me up at night, is that people would still not believe that this is a deadly and really debilitating disease. So we need more voices. We need more people to step up and be heard. And I think that slowly that's what will change things. It's not going to take just the rock stars. Dr. Fauci is a rock star. It's going to take your pastor. It's going to take your teachers. It's going to take your social workers. I mean, the people in the community. And I think that's beginning to happen. I know it's happening in Boston. There are a great many community leaders who are stepping up to try to, you know, help our community get the facts and then respond.
That's Reverend Liz Walker, formerly a news anchor for WBZ-TV and now the pastor of Roxbury Presbyterian Church. She's also on Governor Baker's COVID-19 Vaccine Advisory Group. Thanks for joining us today. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Do you like apples?
Yeah.
I got a number. How do you like them apples?
Okay, sorry. We couldn't resist a little Goodwill Hunting throwback because our next segment is all about apples. How to identify them, buy them, and of course, how to eat and cook with them. Amy Traverso is a longtime friend of our show. She's the senior food editor at Yankee Magazine, and she's an unabashed apple stan and the author of a newly revised and updated Apple Lovers Cookbook. And she's going to take your calls today, so pull up a chair to the table. What are your favorite ways to enjoy and cook apples? Maybe you've got a family time-honored recipe. Maybe you're afraid of apples and want some advice on how to cook them so that that they're firm and tasty and a great blend of flavors. Or maybe there's a tradition around apples you want to share going into this Thanksgiving. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Amy Traverso, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so you shatter a bunch of stuff right off the back of bat with this cookbook because we talk about, you know, American is apple pie. Apples are a typical American fare, but you start the cookbook by saying, nope, apples are not from around here.
No, and you know, when I first started researching this book, I fully expected to read that, you know, the first Europeans stepped off their boats and the shore was like lined with apple trees. And in fact, the sweet apples that we eat are not native to North America. There are crab apples that are native, but apples actually first came, the apples that we know today, first kind of arose in these forests, these wild forests in the foothills of the Tian Shan Mountains, which border China and Kazakhstan. And so if you could sort of picture maybe the Berkshires, but instead of being covered with, you know, maple trees and birch trees, it's wild apples and pears and apricots. It's just fruit. And I haven't been to this corner of the world, but it is 100% on my bucket list because these forests still exist. And I've talked to people, I actually know a woman who's grew up right near these hills. And she absolutely talked about, you know, going as a child, you just go into the woods and pick fruit. And not all of it would be delicious, but a lot of it would be. And so it's still something people are doing today.
So if you had told me before I started reading your book that I would care about 4 million years of apple history, I admit I might have been a little skeptical, but it was fascinating. And I was really interested in how we got to the apple being the evil fruit in Adam and Eve.
Yes. So this is always a complicated thing to talk about because it obviously, if you take the Bible literally, that's a different thing. If you think, you know, if your philosophy is everything in here is absolutely literal and in no way metaphorical, then you leave it at that. But even, you know, if you were to even then maybe take one step removed and say, well, apples didn't, you know, if, let's say the area of the world where this story would have taken place, apples wouldn't have grown there, probably would have been something like a pomegranate. And then if you actually decode it a little more, it's kind of a mistranslation of the word for fruit in the original version of the Bible, and probably a mistranslation that was empowered by the fact that the monks who were transcribing the Bible were, you know, living in Northern Europe, where the apple tree was growing abundantly. And so when their idea of fruit would have been apple, it's an easy mistranslation to make because the word malam can mean fruit or apple. But yeah, that the apple was sort of painted with that brush, and it's been hard to shake that reputation. But, you know, like what you said, the apple is, it's this everyday thing that we take for granted. We don't think about apples. They're just there. And yet, in the course of working on this book, I realized that they are a window into a world of culture and history and science. And it's so fascinating. And I love it when, you know, something that you overlook becomes an object of fascination.
Okay, so in a few minutes, we're going to come back to the history, but I have this piece of apple pie that I cooked from your cookbook sitting here that I'm still going to eat in the next few minutes. And I want to start talking about some of the recipes because I want to bring the callers in on this. 1-800-423-8255. You know, what's your experience baking apple pies? Are you a tart, a crisp, a pie, a pudding? What questions do you have? What's your favorite apple? Give us a call. Okay, so in the olden days, we would have done this in the studio. Mm-hmm. Jamie Bologna is the producer on this one. He's joining us. Jamie, are you there in Studio 3 right now?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can. Excellent. So we all would have, Jamie and I would have cooked in the, you know, at WBUR. Amy, you would have prepared something. We couldn't do that, but we all agreed that we would cook something. Amy, what did you make?
So I made a variation on the freeform apple pear cranberry tart, which is on page 231. It's basically, you might call it a galette. It's, you know, it's a kind of rustic pie where you roll out a dough, you put fruit in the middle, and then you fold the dough up over the fruit and bake it. And so I made it because it's perfect for Thanksgiving. It's got cranberries, and I'm trying not to eat it right now because I want to serve it tomorrow, but I think I will have a slice.
Why don't you have a bite right there? Because I'm about to eat a bite of my apple pie. I'll tell you about my pie in a minute.
Great.
Jamie, we're going to eat first. So you tell us, what did you make from the recipe book last
night? Amy, I hope I can make your grandmother proud because I made her apple crisp. And I used three types of apples. So you suggested to use two types, but I used three. I used some store-bought Macintosh apples. I couldn't find any Pink Lady apples at my supermarket, so I used Sweetango, or however you pronounce those.
Perfect. Yep.
Which you write about in the book. And then I had a few of my father's apples. He's got just a couple of apple trees in his yard, and I don't know what the apples are, but I think they're like a Rome apple. They kind of have a thick skin.
Nice.
And, they're delicious, and he grew them, so I thought, okay, maybe I'll use some of those. And please don't take any offense to this. I was a little surprised at how simple the recipe was. And so.
Oh, yeah.
But then I was so delightfully happy with its simplicity. I mean, it was flour, sugar, eggs, some baking powder. And, you sort of throw all that with some butter right on top of the apples. And
all the good stuff.
It just came great. So.
Jamie. I love. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. Amy.
No, Amy, jump in. Go, Amy.
Well, so I just want to say quickly, this recipe is not your typical apple crisp. It doesn't have oats in it. It is the one I grew up with. It's my, most beloved childhood recipe. And my grandmother found it in a 1945 issue of Country Gentleman magazine. She tore it out and saved it. And I actually have the original copy. And back then you'd make it with margarine and it was a little bit different. We adapted it slightly, but it's so simple. It's like a cross between a snickerdoodle cookie and a biscuit, the topping.
Yes, I
and
know.
It's just delicious.
I was so skeptical. I poured the butter on top and I'm thinking, this is so much butter. And then of course I'm like, this is so much butter. That's perfect.
So how was it,
Jamie?
It's sitting right here in front of me. I'll have a little bit, but couldn't wait until today to eat it. We ate some last night as well. And
all right, Jamie's turn to eat. Amy, how was your tart? Was it worth not waiting?
It's so good. It's so good. It's just, it's all the flavors. I use several kinds of apple, and that's something I recommend when you're baking, when you're doing pies or crisps. You want it. Apples range in flavor from a very, if you imagine like a very green vegetal tasting Granny Smith to something like a Galler or Fuji, which is very floral and very delicate. There's this whole rainbow of flavors. And the more apples you use, the more varieties you use, the more flavor you're going to have in your dish. So the fact, Jamie, that you use three varieties, I'm so for that. I think I used three or four varieties in this tart that I made.
And
so
Tiziana, I
feel like
I got to hear about your cake. I want to hear about your pie.
I feel like I underachieved. I used only two kinds of apples because I'm a little bit compliant, and that is what the recipe said to do, Amy.
Rules, they're meant to be broken.
So it said, and this was new to me. Okay, so I have been on a kick of baking apple pies lately. I have a 15-year-old son whose apple pie is like his favorite thing. So I've been making some homemade apple pies. How bad is it that I didn't even know you could use more than one kind of apple? But your recipe, Amy, calls for a firm tart and a firm sweet. So I used Granny Smith and Golden Delicious in thin slices.
Perfect.
And you have this whole matrix in your cookbook of types of apple. You know, there's firm and there's soft and there's tart and there's sweet. I'm going to take another bite of my pie and then I'll tell you more about it. Tell us a little bit about that matrix, because who knew that we had so many categories of apple?
So when I first started working on the book, I thought it was just going to be, delicious apple recipes. Yay. And then I realized even in the supermarket, even in the most basic supermarket, you have four or five varieties to choose from and they don't come with labels. And if you think about you usually, when you go to the produce department, you have oranges, lemons, strawberries, and then you have Granny Smith, Fuji, Gala, and they behave very differently. Fuji and Gala are very tender and they melt more quickly, whereas a Granny Smith will hold up longer in the oven. So I thought, I don't have to just do recipes. I can actually be helpful here. And so I organized 70 varieties of apple into four categories. And so there's firm tart, which are great for baking like pies. And that would be, your Granny Smith, Northern Spy, which is an antique apple, Rome, Jamie mentioned Rome, Roxbury Russet, which is the oldest American apple, comes from Boston in 1630. And then there's firm sweet, which are like your Honeycrisp and the Pink Lady and the Sweet Tango, and there are a lot of the new apple varieties are firm sweet, Cosmic Crisp, and then Tender Tart is like the Macintosh, makes an amazing apple sauce, cooks down really quickly, Tender Sweet is the last one, and that would be Fuji Gala, the British Apple, Cox's Orange Pippin, and those are also great for pancakes, for sauces, things that are delicate.
So, Amy, we're going to say goodbye to Jamie here because he's going to go back into the control room. Mm. Jamie, thanks for baking with us.
Thank you. Sorry, my mouth is full. I've got to go.
That's perfect. Perfect. And I want to put the number out again in case anyone else wants to join this conversation and eat on the line with us, because we are chowing. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So let's talk about this apple pie for a second, because I have to admit, I have not in my life been a fan of the texture of cooked apples. And so I've always used like a Macintosh because it gets very soft. And when you said use a couple of firm apples, I was like, oh man, I'm going to put all this work into this pie and I'm not going to like it very much because of the texture. Mm-hmm. But I followed your directions for how to slice it, cooked it just the way you said, and it's perfect. I mean, it's just got this wonderful mouthfeel as well as flavor. So what can we learn about how to prepare apples so that we get the outcome we want when it comes out of the oven?
Yeah, so it all has to do with how well or how the apple responds to heat. And does it hold up? Can you bake it for a full hour like you usually will bake a pie, somewhere between, 50 minutes and an hour? Will it kind of hold up? And so it's the variety matters, and then how you slice the apple matters, because if you cut it thinly, it will cook more quickly. And if you cut it into bigger pieces, it will cook more slowly. For an apple pie, I like a firm apple. I do like the slices to be soft but distinct. However, some people like saucy pies, and that's fine. That's how my grandmother cooked. She always made her pies with Macintosh, and they were kind of like a really delicious sauce inside the crust. If you want to kind of split the difference, you could make an apple pie with some firm apples and then throw in a couple of Macintosh, so you have a texture almost like, slices suspended in a sauce. So you're choosing your variety and then you're cutting them. For pie, I like kind of half inch wedges, somewhere between a quarter and a half inch wedge, and that will kind of hold up just long enough to make it out of the oven.
All right, we got lots of calls. Let's pick up Rachel from Everett. Rachel, go ahead.
Hi, I am a big apple fan and I like making apple butter. I tried it a couple of years ago and now I make it all the time, but I make it in a crock pot and I'm wondering if there is a more classic way to make apple butter.
Well, Rachel, I'm glad you said that. I actually do have a slow cooker apple butter recipe in the book, but if you don't mind kind of You can make it in the oven. That's another way to do it. You want to do like a very low oven, 300 degrees for hours and kind of go in periodically and stir it. That's a really nice way to make it. You can also make it on a stovetop, but you have to just kind of be around to keep an eye on it. But, what do we have right now but time at home? So if you want to try a new method, absolutely. I would say the oven is nice because you're cooking off moisture in, and you get a really nice concentrated result. You just want to keep low and slow is your motto when you're making apple butter. And I also like to make apple butter with the skins on, and then I run the puree through, a ricer or a food mill, because the skins have so much flavor and they also add color. And so you get this beautiful like brick red color to your apple butter. So both of those things work well. And for a secret spice, let me just recommend, in addition to the usual cinnamon, nutmeg, that kind of your typical apple spices, there's a spice many people will know called star anise, and it looks like a little dried flower. It looks like a woody little flower, and it has this very delicate kind of licorice taste, but it's not strong like licorice. It's much softer and more fragrant, and it's so good in apple butter. So try that next time.
Okay, so while we get another call in queue here, I have a quick question for you, and this is just the evil in me coming out. You really just do a job on Red Delicious. You are not kind.
Oh my gosh.
In your book.
It's such a tragedy.
So tell us.
Yes. The Red Delicious Apple really was delicious at one point. It was called a Hawkeye originally when it was first discovered in an orchard. It was just a tree that had grown up in somebody's orchard. And we can talk about how apple varieties kind of get discovered, but, and it was amazing. And it was a creamy kind of, it was a red streaked apple. It had sort of red streaks on a yellow background. And, you know, a farmer found it, tasted it, thought it was amazing, ultimately sold this apple to the Stark brothers, which was, you know, a nursery that marketed new varieties. And the Stark brothers, you know, found it to be incredibly popular. They called it the delicious apple. But what they found was people, every apple tree will have a little bit of variation in the fruit it puts out. They're called sports. So you'll have like a slightly different apple growing on the same tree. And they found that the apples that were more uniformly red would sell better. So they started to favor those apples and to kind of graft those branches onto other trees. And what they essentially did was they bred all the flavor out of the red delicious, out of the delicious apple, because it turns out the genes for redness were not, you know, were on different chromosomes than the genes for deliciousness. And they lost those chromosomes. So that's how we ended up with that sad apple.
That sad apple. Okay. So we've got a couple more calls and limited time here. So let's get Martha on the line from Arlington. Martha, go ahead.
Hi. So I'm calling about old-timey apples, like real old-timey apples for pies, ones that are so sour you cannot eat them out of hand.
Mm.
I would drive to the ends of the earth to find one. Do you know any orchards that produce the old ones, really old,
yes,
sour ones?
Yes, there are great orchards. There are many, but let me direct you to Scott Farm in Dummerston, Vermont. It was one of the best because they grow at least 130 varieties. I also love to go to Neshoba Valley Winery, which is in Bolton, Massachusetts, much closer to Boston. They have an heirloom orchard that you have to make an appointment to pick from because they don't have a lot of, but they're very accommodating. You just call ahead and say, I'd like to pick from the heirloom orchard, and they will say, okay, you can come on Saturday. You know, it's very simple. They have more than 100 varieties, and they have those amazing old apples. Also, there are a lot of cider makers in New England now, which is an amazing, this is a fantastic thing. And you could call a cider maker and say, where do you get your apples? Do you grow your own? Because those really sour apples make an amazing hard cider. So they know where to get them. And one that I'd love to tell you to look for is called Redfield, which is wonderful and sour. It has red flesh. It looks like cranberry red on the inside, and it almost tastes like cranberries. And you would love that for pie.
Okay, we're going to try very quickly to get one more call in. Will is on 93. Will, be brief. What's your question?
Can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Hey. Yeah, my name is Will. I'm in my car. My mom, instead of using cinnamon in America, they use too much cinnamon. I'm from the UK originally, and my mother used to make lovely apple pies, but she would put cloves right in the middle, and the cloves would, the taste would gradually seep out to the edge. So the apple pies were brilliant. And over here, nobody makes apple pies with cloves, which is a shame. Too much cinnamon in the USA. Sorry, folks, but that's it.
Well, I do love a good clove.
I actually hear you. Yes, I actually, the tart that I made this morning does have clove in it. So you might want to look for that. It's on page 231. It's a apple pear cranberry tart, and it has cloves in it.
Okay, so we have about a minute left. I'm listening to you, right? I read the book. Obviously, I know you love apples, but I am listening to your enthusiasm. Why do you love apples so much? Where does this come from for you?
I mean, I love their flavor. It's the diversity. It's the fact that there are thousands, there are actually an infinite number of apple varieties in the world, but there are thousands that we know, and they all have different personalities, and they connect me to New England, where I grew up. They connect me to other parts of the world where they originated, and they are so versatile in cooking, from sweet to savory. I can do anything with them, and so they've just been this window through which I can engage with the world and offer people something useful to do in the kitchen and something delicious. And they just make me happy.
All right. In a word or two, the first apple recipe someone should try.
Apple crisp, because you can't mess it up. and it's delicious, and it'll just make you feel good.
Well, this has been such a treat. I love the recipe, by the way. Strongly recommend the double crust apple pie recipe. That's Amy Traverso, senior food editor at Yankee Magazine and the author of the revised update edition of The Apple Lover's Cookbook, The Classic Guide to Cooking and Eating Apples. Amy, thanks for being with us. This was a blast, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving. Thank you.
Tomorrow is Thanksgiving, and it's going to be a different kind of Thanksgiving, one unlike anything that any of us have experienced. So I want to take a moment to express gratitude to you and our guests. Together, you have helped us lean so thoughtfully into the reality and the complex emotions of this holiday, which comes in the middle of a pandemic and of a reckoning about who we are as a people and what we stand for. Wampanoag historian Hartman Dietz reminded us that Thanksgiving, celebrated this year alongside the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the Mayflower, is always a painful and complex day for his people.
The Mayflower is, you know, something that we've taught a mythology around the Mayflower, and it doesn't always reflect the truth of the history of the lives of these people.
Social worker Claire Willis gave us permission to feel grief over losses big and small this Thanksgiving and reminded us to recognize that people grieve in myriad ways.
Grief really has as many faces as there are people who are grieving. So it often shows up as impatience, irritability. Anxiety is another big expression of grief. Anger and rage, which we can often see in politically, certainly. Gratitude and sometimes even relief are all expressions of grief.
And a caller, Tom from Norwood, invited us to go ahead and feel some joy and to actually let the strangeness of this year's holiday be the source of that joy.
This is going to be the best Thanksgiving ever. The reason is because it's going to be different. You know, we're going to remember this for years to come.
For me, as a child, our family Thanksgivings were always a mixture of celebration and reckoning, things to remember. I will never forget the year, for instance, when I renumbered myself in the sibling lineup. See, I'm the 9th of 9 children, but I used to say I was number 8 of 8. We all did. Our brother Christopher died as a baby, and none of us really knew him. But one unforgettable Thanksgiving dinner, during the prayer before the meal, my dad declared, "I can't do this anymore. I had 9 children." I never said 8 again. And that Thanksgiving, I learned that a blessing left uncounted can create a hole of its own. So today, I count my blessings. Thank you, Radio Boston listeners, guests, callers, and supporters. And I am most grateful to the Radio Boston team, Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Zoe Mitchell, Paris Alston, Walter Wuthman, Marquise Neal, and Hitesh Hathi. On behalf of all of us, the whole Radio Boston team, happy Thanksgiving in whatever form it takes for you this year.